You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Hey guys, welcome to the Choose FI Radio podcast. This episode is going to be awesome. We have Scott Trench with us here today. And for those of you that are not aware of the Trenchinator, he is the vice president of operations over at Bigger Pockets. He has a new podcast called Bigger Pockets Money. He has a new book, Set for Life. And he's also obsessed with personal finance, constantly exploring how he can make these concepts by people like Mr. Money Mustache and Joshua Dorkin and Brandon Turner. How can he take the foundation that they've laid and make it work for everyone? And I think he is someone that is incredibly relatable, and he's incredibly good at turning these ideas on a blog into real life examples and helping people grasp these concepts and apply them to their own life. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
I am doing great, Jonathan. Yeah, this is what I've been looking forward to for a while. We have had the good fortune of meeting Scott both at FinCon and at Camp 5 recently. I almost describe him as like an old soul. He's just a genuinely nice human being. When you talk to him, you know he's interested in you. He asks questions. I mean, he's only 27 years old, and yet he is the VP of operations at Bigger Pockets. He's well on the path to financial freedom, has a net worth in the many hundreds of thousands, just because he followed the advice of people like Mr. Money Mustache, and he took action. I just can't wait to hear his story and to bring him to the Choose FI audience. So with that, Scott, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys. That was a really nice intro. I appreciate it.
This is an episode that I am incredibly excited about, because what you've put together, you kind of look at this problem and you say it needs to be simpler. You know, when I look at like people like Mr. Money Mustache and what they've done over at Bigger Pockets, like these are guys that have broken down these concepts, but there's a way for me to even streamline this process. And I love your line, make it work for everyone. I'd love to hear a little bit of your backstory and hear what was it like for you, and at what point in your life did you stumble onto the two respective communities, the FI community and the real estate community?
Yeah, sure. So I went to school in Nashville, Tennessee, and my parents paid for most of my college education. So I was able to graduate debt-free with about $3,000 to my name, which is a great head start. Actually, after college, I went to Europe and spent the, you know, I think I had like $8,000. I spent like $5,000 backpacking around Europe with a couple of buddies before starting my full-time job that I got out of college. So that was my starting point. I had a wonderful time meeting lots of friends in school, going around Europe. You know, I had a lot of internships, did well, all that kind of stuff. I get into my first full-time job. It's at a Fortune 500 company. And in 2012, it was the meanest company in America to work for.
Is that objectively?
Is that based? That was objectively. That was objectively. So if you want to Google what company I work for, you can figure it out if you do some research and go Google meanest company to work for 2012. You know, that was where I started my career. And
I'm totally going to Google that and put it in the show notes.
Absolutely. But the blessing that I had from being in that environment was it made me realize, hey, I can't do this for the next 20, 30, 40 years, the traditional length of a career. And there was two parts to this. So one, I realized that gradually over the first 3 months. It wasn't like it just hit me one day as the work became, you know, there wasn't enough work. There wasn't enough opportunity for me to really kind of do all the things I wanted to do. So I would finish my work in a few hours, and then I would be like, I'm getting paid to be here. So I'm going to go and learn how to do my job better and better and better. I became an Excel guru by taking courses in Excel at work to continue to streamline my process. And then I wanted to learn about finance. I was a financial analyst. So I was like, okay, I'm going to read a lot of different blogs and things on finance, how to be a better financial analyst. And in the course of that search, at some point, I must have stumbled across the concept of personal finance. There's a natural overlap between if you're interested in corporate finance and, you know, personal finance. I don't know exactly when it was, but I began discovering some of these concepts for personal finance. And I think the first time that I really understood the concept of financial freedom and financial independence was on the Radical Personal Finance podcast. The first guest on that podcast ever was a guy named Mr. Money Mustache. And I remember that kind of changing my mindset and that I began reading his blog sometimes at work. And over the course of that 3 to 6 month period after starting that job, that's when I really became enamored with the concept of financial independence there.
So, Scott, I know that you use that word financial freedom. Is there any significant difference in your mind between financial freedom and financial independence?
No, I think it's all one and the same. The problem is I wrote a book on the subject, so my editor made me you're going to choose one or the other. So I just always use financial freedom now, and that's just my default because I've been trained to do that. I think there's no difference between the terms. I like financial freedom better than financial, not necessarily than financial independence, but I like it better than retirement, just because sometimes people dismiss the idea of retirement. But financial freedom is not about necessarily retiring. It's just having the option to do whatever you want to do.
Makes total sense. I do have a follow-up on that. So one of the things that you do so well is you bridge the gap between the real estate world and the financial independence world. There's very few other influencers in our space that are doing that as well as you. I would say maybe Coach Carson is another one. And to me, that is such an obvious parallel storyline. I mean, I remember looking at the financial independence community from the outside a year or two ago, and at the same time, so I would spend my time listening to the Bigger Pockets podcast, and that would be like on the way to work. And then when I got home and on the weekends and at night, I would be reading or listening to either the Mad Scientist or reading Mr. Money Mustache and, you know, J.L. Collins and people in that particular space. But there was never any cross communication. And it seems so obvious that these two communities are linked arm in arm if it's framed the right way. But nobody was speaking that message. Nobody was tailoring their message to that idea, to that overlap, until I found your book, Set for Life.
Well, I think there's four things that actually are the four levers behind personal finance that I, as I define them. One is your savings rate, right? One is your investment approach. One is your earned income approach. And then the fourth is going to be your asset creation approach. You know, you can find that as business. And there's going to be some overlap between asset creation and income generation, of course. But there's really those four areas are the things that people can do. Now, some segments of this community of wealth building will focus in on just one of these areas and they pigeonhole themselves. You know, it's orthodox, for example, for some people to be like, oh, it's all about savings. The only way to reach FIRE is to save as much as possible, have a couple of hacks like, you know, travel hacking or whatever, and then invest in index funds. And that's how you achieve FIRE. And there's really no other way. Well, there's a ton of different ways and they all work. Well, I believe, I certainly agree with those folks that the foundation of this plan is that 50% savings rate. You know, what that does for you is as you begin accumulating assets, it begins to enable you to take chances and pursue opportunities in these other areas for income generation, more creative investing that can produce better returns, and then the creation of assets from scratch or the acquisition of businesses.
Yeah, Scott, I completely agree. It's certainly short-sighted if people portray that as the only path, the save half your money and put it in index funds and that's it. I mean, clearly there are many different levers and I like your list of four there. I just want to slow down for a quick second. When you were describing your first couple months on the job, what stuck out to me was lifelong learning. You talked about, hey, I got great at Excel. I wanted to be the best financial analyst. So I took these courses. That strikes me based on my experience as unusual in that many people don't go out of their way to be that lifelong learner. And I think it's so essential. I'm curious where you pick that up. Have you always been someone who tries to learn various different skills? And how has that impacted your life favorably?
So I was thinking about this the other day, and I think what it comes down to is I have very high expectations from life. And some people do not have high expectations from life. Some people are like, I'm going to work this job for the next 40 years and, you know, do this and then I'll retire with modest amount of wealth and that'll be it. You know, but I think that us in the financial independence community, you're not really going to be interested in financial independence in the first place if you're expecting to get by, to just get by in life. You have to expect to want more. And I think that when I was starting my job, I saw it as a great opportunity. I hustled to get that job. I networked with people. You know, I had an internship at the company the year before. And I networked with the finance team because I wanted to be in the finance team. I was one of the few people to get a job in the corporate finance department without an MBA. And I expected for that effort to be my effort to produce some rapid rewards and opportunities for me. And when that began to not materialize, I realized that no matter how much effort I was putting in, the more work I did, the more work I was given. And when I had good ideas, I was really not able to really get them to have attention from the company, if that makes sense. So yes, I was attempting at all times, I think perhaps unusually, to provide more value to the company with every passing day to the best of my ability. And when that began to cease being rewarded, when my expectations for better than average results from better than average effort were not being met, that was when I began to get disillusioned, I think, and that accelerated my yearning for financial freedom.
And so that disillusionment, that set in fairly quickly, right? Like within the first handful of months of being at this Fortune 500 company?
Yes, I discovered, I think that I was completely on board with the concept of financial independence. I think I started in August and I was completely on board by January. In the meantime, I made one of my big financial mistakes, which was buying my brand new car. However, it was a Toyota Corolla. Brand new Toyota Corolla isn't so bad, but that was my...
You're wasting the hot seat questions, man. You're burning through content here.
Oh, sorry. That is a hot seat. I have that as my hot... Yes.
That's great.
You know, one of the things... So I listened to you at the Camp Fi that we were at recently, and one of the points that you made that was so powerful to me was your definition of luck. And I'm going to have to paraphrase it because I didn't write down the exact quote, but I came away with, luck is the intersection of preparation and opportunity. What I would love to hear you talk about for a few minutes is you're now the vice president of operations at Bigger Pockets, a company which by any standard is blowing up. I mean, it's a massive company and it started with one guy trying to build something out of his living room for years. You know, you and the team there have kind of set it on this exponential growth, which is fascinating. But I'm curious, how do you go from someone that is just miserable in the meanest job in the country to someone that is thriving as an employee in someone else's business?
Yeah, so let me describe to you a chain of good luck that happened over the course of this period from, let's call it January 2014 till July 2014. So at this point, I was all on board with financial independence. And while I loved Mr. Money Mustache was the guy who got me going on it, saving up $25,000 was my reality for the first year. That was all I was going to be able to do. You know, I was Ubering after work. I started trying these little side businesses that failed one by one. I began accumulating my savings. And I was like, how do I invest these more efficiently? Index fund investing is great, but if I'm going to expect 10% returns, I'm going to be here for 15 more years, even if I'm doing my best here. So I need to start changing some things. So I began meeting people for lunch all the time. I explored the concept of network marketing, multi-level marketing, which I don't know. You know, I considered that. I met with like five people who did that, and I just didn't get good vibes from any of the people I met. And so I'm really glad I stayed away from that. I'm glad I tried my business. I tutored math, and I just talked about investing in real estate all the time, every chance I got. Now, the first stroke of really good luck came to me when I was walking this dog. And the reason I was walking this dog is my friend was – she had bad knees and she lived in downtown Denver. And she had the cutest Australian sheepdog. Now, that's a terrible thing for an animal because it's cooped up in this thing. So I would go run this dog and I would attempt to pick up girls at the local park. And this was unsuccessful every time. I was very unlucky in that pursuit. However, I did take a break and sit down on a park bench with this guy. And we start talking stocks and entrepreneurship. And he's like 65, retired, hanging out. And so I pick up this old dude at the park and he invites me to his mastermind meeting, which is every Thursday morning or once a month on Thursday mornings at 7 o'clock in the morning. That was a turning point in my life. When I attended that first mastermind meeting, I was like, these guys are good. One guy owned 10 properties in Denver and was flipped five or six houses a year. One guy owned a real estate firm that did probably over $100 million in real estate transactions. One guy was a property manager. One guy was starting a landscape company that ended up not working out, and he went on to be successful with a venture a few years later. But these guys were smart guys. And here I am, this 22, 23-year-old kid, not knowing anything, and they're allowing me to tag along and learn from them. So I take every single one of these guys out to lunch. I'm taking one of them out to lunch. It's actually the guy who owned that real estate brokerage. And he works in the same co-working space as a guy named Josh Dorkin. Now, Josh Dorkin is the founder of Bigger Pockets. And at the time, it was him and another guy named Brandon Turner. And those are the only two employees at the company. I had been listening to the Bigger Pockets podcast. I was a huge fan of the podcast. I'm sure many of your listeners are huge fans of you guys. It would be like them running into one of you just randomly while networking. And like, suppose that you'd been following the Choose FI podcast for months, had been following the advice, had been networking with people who are ahead of you, and ran into one of them. You'd be like, oh my God, I'm doing exactly what you told me to do, Josh. You're my hero. You've changed my life. My perspective is different. I love what you're doing. You know, can I come work for you? Can I come help you out in some way, like for free on the weekends or after work? I just want to meet investors and learn, get more knowledge. Josh blows me off. He says, go away, kid. What are you doing?
And I have a feeling he literally did that.
Yeah, literally what happened. So, and he's like, no, you know, I'm busy. I hate it when people come in who know me and disrupt my work. Like, I was like, oh, come on. And I follow up like six. He was nicer than that. I'm exaggerating. But I follow up like six more times, basically saying, hey, can I get you? Can I buy you lunch? Can I take you out to a beer? Can I just learn from you? Whatever. And finally, he invites me in. And it turns out that invite was actually a job interview. And I sit down and there it is. There's Josh. And he's asked me questions if I want to apply for a job as an operations guy at the company. We get on the Skype and we pull up Brandon, who's also a hero of mine. And these guys are interviewing me. And I'm like, wow, what's going on here? And, you know, they give me a couple of tasks to do. I complete them and I get the job. And at the time, it was a little risky because I went from a very stable Fortune 500 company, even if it was a mean company, to a startup with two employees. I had no idea what the financials were. I had no idea what how the company was doing. All I knew was that it was changing my life and that I thought it would, you know, from what I could gather, it was changing hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of other people's lives as well. And so that's how I got the job at BiggerPockets. And so you can see it. There's a stream of luck that connected all of these events there. Yet, you know, if I hadn't been so obsessed with finance, I would never have that conversation with the guy in the first place. If I hadn't been serious about my goal to achieve that, I wouldn't have got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, biked over in the cold weather to this meeting. They used to say that I look like an airline pilot because I would wear my ski helmet because it was so cold on my bike to these meetings at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I met with all these guys, and then I wouldn't have taken each one out to lunch. And I'm really frugal, spending the money to take people out to lunch and to learn from them, and then met Josh Dworkin, right? And that was the stream of luck and preparation that got me to get a job at a company that I was really a big fan of and believed in. And then, of course, I've continued to try to learn and grow, and we've had a lot of opportunities. And luckily, more and more people seem to like what BiggerPockets is about and come to the site, and it's grown, and we've gone from there.
Scott, I love that intersection of luck and preparation there. And I really hope the audience stops and picks up some of the important mental skills that you just talked about, which are having high expectations from life while most people don't, having this positive outlook, always looking for opportunities, taking those coffees, taking those lunches. When we met at Campfire, you said every single person that emails you about, hey, let's go out for coffee or let's go out for lunch, you take those meetings. That's just such a cool outlook on life. And I really want to commend you on it. And I also want to point that out to the audience, certainly. I also just want to real quickly ask you about that first meeting, when you're there with the dog and sitting on the park bench with this 65-year-old guy. You're a 22-year-old kid, as you described yourself. What do you think occurred in that meeting that led him to invite just some random 22-year-old kid with a borrowed dog to this meeting of high-powered investors?
I think it's all networking. I was genuinely interested in investing. I was generally, the conversation started with stock investing. At the time, I was still new to financial independence and was interested in stock picking. You know, I was a very unsuccessful stock picker myself. And so we were talking about that for a while, but I was more interested in entrepreneurship. I was just interested in the concept of wealth generation, business building, all that kind of stuff. And so we must have talked for an hour about this stuff. And I think I was just genuinely interested in it and was delighted to find a guy that had experience doing all the things that I wanted to do later in life. I think that was why he invited me there. And I think that's the point. If you are obsessed with something, if you love something, if you're passionate about something, if you want something badly, you're going to learn about it. You're going to think about it a lot. You're going to talk to other people a lot about it. And as you get to do that, you're going to find serendipitously maybe people that share your interests and understand when it's something that you want to do.
You know, we could probably just latch onto this one segment and spend all of our time here just talking about the value of networking from a good place, not in a swarmy type of what can I get out of you? How can I close the deal? But what I loved about your story is you always led with how can I help you? You know, that is how you're going. And you go to Josh and you say, I love what you've done. You've had an impact on my life. How can I help you? How can I exchange my time on the weekends in any way help you with what you're working on? And the other half of that is, you've latched onto this from the very beginning. And I think for many of us, it takes many, many years to realize this. But the most valuable thing is not a W-2 paycheck. I think all of us get latched onto having that safety and security. But you can tell from where you were putting your time that for you, it was accumulating knowledge, accumulating information, and partnering with people that could get you onto this fast lane to that information, and then assimilating that into your life, actually taking action with it. I think that information, you can get paralysis analysis where you just sit on everything. But I think as we go through your story, I think what we'll see over and over again is it's those three or four actionable tips. You go in with, how can I help? You realize that the most valuable thing is actually this information. And then that extra step, you actually take action with this stuff time and time again.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary of how to increase the odds of success. And we talked about those four areas of finance, right? Saving money, earning more income, investing, and building assets. But the earning more income and the creation of assets, they are going to be reliant on opportunity, things that are outside of your control. I think those things don't guarantee success. They increase your odds of success. And the more you do them, the more you increase your odds. The harder you work, the luckier you get. The more you prepare, the more opportunities that will present themselves to you. It's a numbers game. It's like sales. You know, you never know how many times you're going to sell something if you make 100 cold calls. But you know, if you make 100 cold calls, you're going to sell more than if you make 10.
Scott, I think your walkthrough of your story up to this point sets the framework for somebody that is positioning themselves to obtain good information from reliable sources. And then, as we've discussed, you have take action with it. And so that is essentially, that's the premise for the book that you wrote, Set for Life. That is exactly what you've done. You've tried to take these information from these different influencers and distill it down to something that anybody can access. I know that in your book, you described the three stages of wealth creation. I'd love to hear you unpack that for us.
Yeah. So the first, and I'll go through my story as I describe this, right? So I told you about meeting this guy and the transition over to BiggerPockets in July of 2014. Well, throughout that period from August to about July, August 2013 to July 2014, I'd been saving a lot of money. I've been packing lunches, all those things that Mr. Money Mustache preaches. It gave me the confidence to do a couple of things. One, we had an employee stock purchase program, which allowed me to buy stock at a discount. Other people couldn't buy the stock at a discount because they couldn't live for 3 or 4 months without a paycheck while you set aside this money. And then they would basically set aside money into this account. And at the end of the quarter, they'd buy the stock and you get this gain. And I remember being so baffled that other people would not take a 15% employee discount on stock and just realize an immediate gain. But I could do that because I had savings. I had cash set aside and a low expense rate that allowed me to do that. And that allowed me to stockpile my cash throughout the first two quarters of 2014. So, I'm coming out in June, July of 2014 with $25,000 in savings when my peers, who maybe made more than me, were unable to save even a fraction of that. And that was the position from which I began to kind of seek some opportunities. Now, my interest in BiggerPockets at first actually wasn't necessarily that I wanted to become a real estate investor. I was more interested in continuing to increase my savings rate. I was so ingrained in the mustache approach, and still am, that I wasn't really even thinking too hard about building a real estate portfolio. I was thinking, how do I reduce my housing expenses? And the best way I thought to do that was from an article by Mr. Brandon Turner here at BiggerPockets, which is called How to Hack Your Housing and Get Paid to Live for Free. And he published that in late 2013, and I stumbled across it in early 2014. That was when the light bulb went off in my head. I was like, that's why I'm saving. I'm saving so I can buy a house hack. And oh, by the way, buying this house hack I bought this place for $240,000. I put down $12,000. I put about $8,000 into it. And this is all at the end of 2014. So November 2014 is when I actually closed on the property. I fixed it up over the course of 3 or 4 months. And when I was finished, I had a tenant living on the other side for $1,150 and a roommate in my side for $550 for a total of $1,700 in rent. And $1,550 was my principal interest, taxes, insurance, and mortgage insurance premium. And then I did all the work myself and fixed it all. That was a huge savings. I had eliminated my housing expense, and I was within biking distance of my new job, which was BiggerPockets at that time.
So what strikes me is everything you've said up to this point is still core to the FI message. And it's that Wealth creation begins with frugality. I love that you don't limit yourself to frugality, but you start there. And when you're looking at your expenses on a pie chart, it becomes very obvious that your main expense on that pie chart is your cost of living, your rent, your mortgage. So basically what you did is once you analyze that, you are then able to come up with a plan to crush that particular aspect of the pie chart.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about it as I was a financial analyst and I was getting pretty good at being a financial analyst because I was putting in so much time trying to get better at my job, right? I was like, okay, I'm looking at this and, you know, no one's talking about housing here. They're talking about packing a lunch. That's great. I'm packing a lunch. They're talking about, you know I spend a little too much money on beer. I'm not giving that up. How am I actually going to achieve a high savings rate? It's got to be through housing. And so that was why I went into like real estate. I was like, okay, I can buy real estate. Maybe I can work hard and generate passive income to pay for my housing. I was unable to put it together that a house hack was the right idea, the right way to go about things until I read that article and had it explained to me. But once it was explained to me, it became super obvious. And by the way, if you look at that pie chart that we were talking about, if you're trying to visualize this, 33%, one third is housing. 17%, the next chunk is transportation. 17 plus 33 is 50. 50% of average American household spending is in just those two categories, just those two. So by house hacking close to work, I lopped off half of my expenses. I was able to spend whatever I wanted in the other areas of life and still achieve a high savings rate, well over 50% once I had done that. And that was the catalyst that propelled me forward. Now, at the same time I was doing this, because I was spending so little and my lifestyle cost so little and I had a large amount of savings, I did feel the confidence also to take that chance on the startup that I believed in, which is BiggerPockets. So I had transitioned the job in July of 2014 and I closed on the property in November of 2014. So those things were happening fairly simultaneously. I was in the middle of offering on the property. I was in the middle of offering on properties right when I transitioned jobs. And then that property happened to come along a few months later. So between those two things, you know, that was what set the stage for really a acceleration towards FI after that.
Scott, you kind of nonchalantly there said, oh, I read this article and it changed my life and I started taking action. That's a pretty remarkable thing when you think about it. Yeah. A lot of people, give yourself some credit, like a lot of people consume tons of content and don't take action. I've found what sets people apart who are successful in life and who aren't are you doing things? Are you getting up off that couch and taking action and not just consuming? Okay, you have this lightning bolt moment about this house hack that Brandon Turner wrote. How quickly did you actually say, all right, this is what's happening. I'm making moves right now.
Oh, I think it was immediate. I don't remember what date it was, but all throughout that first and second quarter of 2014, that was when I began meeting with people like this old guy at the park and going and networking and taking people out to lunch and all that kind of stuff. Like as soon as I had that concept in my head, I began learning how to do it. I was not financially in the position to buy a house at that point. I did not have a strong credit history. I did not have enough cash saved up. I had like probably $4,000 or $5,000 in cash in March of 2014 because all of my money was tied up in this employee stock purchase plan that I was getting this, you know, I was set to get this huge wave in April when the quarter ended. I was just not in position to do it, but I was in position to learn and give myself really good odds of success. And I was able, because of that article, to realize, hey, I'm not really buying a house. I'm buying an investment property. And as a result of house hacking, I will become a real estate investor. And so I might as well put myself in position to have the greatest odds of success possible by learning as much as I can about how to make it, how to choose a property in a great location that might appreciate, how to manage tenants, how to find tenants, how to fix repairs, how to do things myself, who to call when I have an emergency. All that kind of stuff were the things that I was doing over the course of that year. The reason I was able to take action off that article wasn't really because like, oh, I was so bold and adventurous. It was because I've been listening to that podcast for months. I've been listening to things like content like this that existed at the time for months. And because of that, my reality, the people I surrounded myself with in my head to and from work at the gym, they were all telling me this is normal. This is the thing to do. It was the people at work that were doing the abnormal things. We didn't talk that much about money. And because the people I was surrounding myself with, even though they didn't know me and they were just talking to me through podcasts and things like that, those were the people that I identified with and was able to take action from. And those are the people that I eventually began associating with in real life.
That's exactly what I've seen as well. The difference between just accumulating information and taking action is immersing yourself in the content and not just reading it, but in finding yourself in a community of like-minded people that are pursuing common goals. And you can certainly get that by listening to a podcast to and from work every single day, following up with information from various articles and blogs. And I think that next aspect of taking it to real life, taking it at least to social media where you're able to communicate back and forth with people and they're able to show you what they're doing and how to improve that message to your particular situation. Basically, taking advantage of the Jim Rohn quote that says you're the average of the five people that you spend the most time with. And the amazing thing about the communities, the respective communities that we're talking about, is that those five people no longer need to be in your same zip code.
Yep. A good example of how this helped me a lot was I was feeling really bad around this time about my Toyota Corolla purchase because it was a brand new 2014 Toyota Corolla that I bought in late 2013. That's when they released the new models. Friends and family thought that was a great idea. Oh, it's such a good economical investment and all that. I read an article, I think it was Mr. Money Mustache again, and he was like, well, if you buy a new car, you've got like 20 years of inventory, and that's a really bad way to run a business. It's not inefficient. You know, I wouldn't print 20 years worth of copies of Set for Life and call that a good business move and then sell them, dwindle them over the next 20 years, right? It's just very uncertain. It's, you know, those kinds of things. But my friends and family did not understand these concepts. They thought I was crazy for even questioning the validity of buying a Toyota Corolla as a smart economical choice. But I remember going on to the Mr. Money Mustache forums and posing this question and getting a lively debate from very smart people that were farther along in the financial journey than me and that had varying opinions. And that, I think, is one of the keys to all of this, is having smart opinions. Going to somebody who's smart in the field that you're interested in and hearing disagreements on how to go about things. Once you can hear those disagreements and acknowledge both sides as smart and having valid points, that's when you begin to be able to make strong decisions. So yes, take it to real life, even if it is on the even if it's real life is the forums in a community that you respect, and get good opinions and be able to recognize good opinions from both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess the place to take this next is to actually hear you talk about this framework that you've built. I mean, so let's even move this away from your story. Let's set the stage by saying that the content that's in your book, you've lived this out. I mean, I don't know if people recognize the math on this, but it's the beginning of 2018. We just said that your journey started in 2014. So in less than 5 years, you are at or now past the point of FI. So the principles that you're talking in the book, we know they work if you implement them. I'm curious, we don't have time. I would just read the book live on the show, but I don't think that's going to add as much value for people in this particular conversation. What is the general framework that you would introduce someone to if they want to be set for life and do it in a period less than 10 years?
Sure. You know, I write the book for someone who is starting with little to nothing, who has immediate income and is attempting to aggressively do exactly what you just said, move toward FI within a period of around 10 years, hopefully less. Well, the first thing you got to do is accept, hey, you have no assets and you have no time. So starting a business after work, people have done it. You will see entrepreneurs who have done it. If you are an entrepreneur and are going to start a business and quit your job with less than 1 year's savings, my book's not for you. There are books out there for you and there's approaches out there for you, and you may be successful and you may get rich very quickly. But the fact of the matter is most people are not going to have the skill set, the desire, or the resources to pull off the creation of a significant amount of additional income if they're working a full-time job already that pays around the median income. So you have to start with saving. Once you start saving, two things begin to happen. And I like to say get up to a 50% savings rate. What happens when you get to a 50% savings rate? Let's say you bring home $50,000 after tax for easy math. I know that's a little above the median in terms of after-tax income. If you save 50%, you save $25,000 per year. The other thing is you're spending $25,000 per year. So that means that you've accumulated this what I call a year of financial runway after 1 year. Now, the reason you're able to accumulate so much runway is a factor of your savings rate in two ways. One, it reduces the amount that you spend each month, allowing you to accumulate more cash. And two, it reduces the amount of runway you need, or amount of cash you have accumulated to support your lifestyle. For example, if you spent $4,000 per month, you'd spend $48,000 per year and save $2,000 in a year. That's half a month of financial runway.
So if I follow what you're saying correctly, basically the goal is to get that first $50,000 a year job. You can tweak that at the margins, but if we can get that first $50,000 a year job and we save 50% of that, very quickly we're going to get up to $25,000. Now you actually roll out for someone that's saying, well, that's not possible, I can't do that. You roll out some strategies for basically how to make that a reality, and it gets a lot easier if you don't have to pay for housing or transportation.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. You have to figure out how to do it. And getting to that median income, unfortunately, in my opinion, is the starting point for the journey to FI. If you're not able to command a median income, you need to do what you got to do to go through the process of, you know, apprenticeship, college, whatever it is that you need to do to get to that median income, because it's going to be very hard to achieve a high savings rate basically anywhere in the country at a significantly lower rate than that. So that needs to be, I think that needs to be a central focus. Once you're there though, yes, the biggest expenses in your life are housing, transportation, food, pensions, healthcare, and then there's this 20% chunk at the pie chart, one fifth, that is entertainment, clothing, apparel, accessories, others, all that kind of stuff. All the fun stuff in your life is that 20%. And you're not going to achieve a 50% savings rate, and you're going to hate your life if you attempt to focus on cutting out that 20% chunk that's all the good times, right? So you focus instead on, how do I reduce my housing expense? How do I get a roommate? You know, move to a house hack if you can. Maybe that it doesn't have to happen overnight. Maybe it happens over the course of a year or two that you approach this point where you can eliminate or drastically reduce your housing expense. And then try to be close to work. And if you do those two things, you're going to make a huge dent in your housing and transportation expense. If you're smart about what you eat, healthy, make reasonable food from reasonable grocery stores, you're going to be pretty good on the food budget. You can still go out for wings with your buddies. That's what I like to do, and I don't regret it. Those fun things in life, the things you enjoy, can still happen while you achieve that 50% savings rate.
Scott, I like how you do not focus too much actually on, as you say, the fun stuff. There's that tendency to look at it from a deprivation point of view. And when you start taking all the fun aspects out of your life, this can become a chore. Whereas you're saying, just be smart with the big stuff. Be smart with the housing, the transportation, the food. So I love that perspective. I'm curious where 401k and other retirement contributions come into this, if at all.
I was not, when I was doing this journey, interested in 401k or retirement contributions. I contributed to a Roth IRA, and then I withdrew all of my contributions in order to purchase my first house hack. So for me, in this stage, if you are super aggressive about achieving financial independence and you're committed to, you know, giving it as good an effort as you possibly can and achieving it in around 10 years, and you're starting young, then the wealth that's in retirement accounts, not being able to access it penalty-free, is a big deal. Even a Roth IRA like I had, where you can withdraw early, not being able to access the gains early is a big deal, because that's the period in your life, if you're going about things the way I was, where opportunities will begin to present themselves, and that's where you need to be able to access that cash in a liquid form in order to pursue those opportunities. The ability to house hack, for example, that, you know, we can talk about this in a minute, but the ROI is literally 100% to 200% return on investment within the first couple of years. And I'll explain why that is, why the math works on that, even in average scenarios, you know, and there's just not a way to do that with retirement accounts. There's not a way to fund your lifestyle while you pursue a business opportunity or take a chance in a sales job or a startup that exists in those retirement accounts. One of the things I think that happens to many people in this country, they take these jobs, these, you know, middle class jobs at corporations, and then they go about, and over the course of, you know, 5-10 years, they ramp up to a salary of 75, 80, maybe even 100K. But almost all of their wealth is trapped in two places, which is their home equity, their mortgage payment, and their retirement accounts. They have very little, less than a year of liquidity outside of those two places. And that pigeonholes them into those jobs and delays their financial freedom. They have to go about it through that rigid formula of save 50% of my income and invest in index funds, because they have no other choice. Because they have no other wealth with which to deploy and take chances. And so the whole point of this is to expose yourself to opportunity, prepare yourself for that possibility of getting lucky, consistently educate, and be able to take advantage of those when they pop up. So that's why I don't use retirement accounts.
That is so controversial, and I love it. Thank you for committing to that. And Brad, that, I'm glad that you slowed down on that, because I was just going to bypass that completely. And I think that that is something that someone is going to have to tease through. But I think, at least with the scenario that you're laying out, if you're fixated on that plan, if you have a plan, then this could work for you. I mean, the math is the math. When we say it's just the function of the math, you need to be very clear on what the pros and the cons are of the plan that you're laying out. But this is doable. I've read through this book, and this is definitely a doable plan. There's a couple things that strike me. I'm thinking about all the reasons that somebody would start listening to this and then bail on your ideas here. And one of them might be, you know, well, I don't make $50,000 a year, so this isn't written for me. And in my mind, it's always about solving the problem. And to me, this is doable. Making it to a $50,000 a year salary is doable. But it's the same problem as everything else. You need to figure out, all right, well, how do I make 50K? How can I position myself to be in a situation to earn that income? And then from there, Scott's not asking you to save $250,000 or reach 25X your annual expenses. He says that first goal is save $25,000. That to me seems very doable. That is low hanging fruit. And it's self-fulfilling in that once you get to the point where you're able to save up 25K, you say, I can do this. I can do anything. And to me, that's really impressive. I think it kind of sets us up for the next stage in this problem. Right, Scott?
Absolutely. I want to throw something out there right now. 2 weeks ago, here in 2018, I decided that this year I am going to begin contributing to retirement accounts. And the reason why I'm doing that is because my company allows me to take a match. And the other part of it is I now have the passive income I need and the ability to accumulate large amounts of liquidity every year. I'm happy with my job and I don't need that money right now. And that's why I'm beginning to put it away into these retirement accounts and take the tax advantages, is because I have more cash than ideas of how to efficiently invest it more creatively. And because my job is getting a little bit more busy here at Bigger Pockets, which I love, I have less time to pursue these creative investments. So I am changing my tune on retirement accounts now. At the time, though, and I do not regret, and I would have done the same thing again, I did not contribute to them during those initial years of wealth building.
But this is not ChooseFI recommending that you not fill up your retirement accounts. Rather, This is if you have a plan that makes sense, that you have tested and run, you know, bounced off other people, that's different than drifting through life and not taking action on anything.
Yes, exactly. Yes. If you don't have a plan, might as well invest in retirement accounts to take the tax advantage. If you do have a plan, you can be a smart person, a reasonable person, and not invest in retirement accounts because you have a way to use that money to pursue opportunities that you think will advance your position far faster.
All right. All disclaimers have been put in place. What's stage two?
All right. Stage two. That's where the income production and house hacking comes in. So let's talk with house hacking first. We talked about how that's a 33% of your largest expense. I briefly went through my first house hack. Now let's talk about return on investment, as I teased earlier. When you buy a real estate property, let's say you have $100,000 and you buy a $100,000 piece of real estate, all right? And that property goes up $5,000, 5% over a year or two. You've made a 5% return. Now let's say you buy the same piece of real estate with $20,000 and have an $80,000 loan, and that property goes up $5,000 or 5% over a year or two. You've now made five times five, right? You've made a 25% return. You see how that works? Because you have $5,000 return on your $20,000 investment.
Yep.
I house hacked and I put down 5%, which is $12,000 on a $240,000 piece of real estate. Now, let's go back to the $100,000 example. If that's $5,000 on a $100,000 property and it appreciates $5,000, that's a 100% return on investment. Yes, you are leveraged, which there's risk, and I'll get to that in a moment, but that kind of average appreciation, 3.5% per year, is going to produce 80% returns for someone that puts down 5% using an owner-occupant real estate loan, which you can do when you're buying a property that you're going to live in. You're also paying down the mortgage, which compounds your return, and hopefully you're paying less, like I was, in rent in order to live. So I had eradicated my rent expense. So if that was $600 a month or $7,200 a year, I'm also putting that cash flow in the form of rent savings into my return on investment. You're talking about 100 to 200% ROI easy in an average appreciation year.
Scott, I love that. And also, I know that you've taken the time to document the risk that goes along with this and how you mitigate that risk. And in my mind, as you're saying this, if your model for investment relies on appreciation, leverage is a double-sided blade that can cut both ways. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about the risk of using leverage and relying on appreciation as opposed to cash flow.
Sure. Many people out there will tell you that buying a home is a good investment. So suppose now that we're not house hacks. Suppose I didn't buy that duplex as a house hack. Suppose I bought it as a single family home. So I put down the same thing, $12,000, and I buy a $240,000 property, and I pay $1,550 a month in my mortgage. This is the position from which people are at great risk. They are highly leveraged and have no help paying down that mortgage, right? If that property goes down, they're underwater and they have to pay, and it doesn't matter. They have no help that they're going to get. With my property, let's suppose the market had gone down. Let's say the property had reduced in price from 240 to 200 and I have a loan for 235. By the way, there are expenses that go along with buying a property and getting a mortgage, and those do deflate some of the returns that I'm talking about in that first year, especially when there's transaction costs that go along with this. So model those things in. But you're still talking about 100% to 200% return if you're able to do some of the things I'm going to talk about in a second here. Now, in my duplex, had tenants paying down the mortgage on the other side and a roommate on my side. Even if rents had fallen, let's say that there was a 30% decrease in rents, a huge rental collapse in the Denver market, right? And rents go from $1,150 to $800. Well, now I'm getting $800 from the other side and $400 from my side. That's $1,200. And I'm paying $350 to continue living. I'm still paying less money in a regular month than my roommate is. And I'm still paying less money than I would if I were to live in that other place. That's called risk reduction. Even though I'm underwater, even if the price falls, I'm still able to live much more efficiently. That's how I perceive the use of leverage as a good way to enter into real estate, even if the market is going to collapse. Now, that said, one of the ways that this works is if you are happy to continue living in that property for as long as you need to. So if your plan is I'm going to buy this property and move out after a year and keep it as a rental property and things are going to be la-di-da-di-da, that can happen. That's happened for me. But I am not so naive as to think that that's going to continue to happen forever. And I'm willing of each additional property I buy to live there for many years happily at a very low cost. Those are the ways that you can reduce your risk when you're going into a house hack and using leverage of owner-occupant loans with 5% or even less down.
Scott, have you done that? Have you moved from house hack to house hack?
Yeah, I've done it twice. I have two places that I've lived as house hacks. So this first duplex I was telling you about for $240, and I live in another one that I bought for $360. At the top, I live in the basement. The top unit rents for about $1,600. I have a roommate there too.
So when you moved on from that first house hack, I assume, did you rent out the other bedroom since you had a roommate in your unit, or did you just... did you know he or she move out as well, and then you rented that entire
unit? Yeah, we both moved out and got a new set of tenants.
Interesting. So, okay.
So I've been house hacking here and achieving this kind of return and paying nothing to live. And so I was just stockpiling cash. At the same time, Bigger Pockets was growing. And because I was a commissioned salesperson, I was able to sell more. So between those two things, taking a reasonable shot at a career prospect that would pay off and increase my income, and house hacking, over the next 2 years, I was able to accumulate nearly over $100,000 in net worth and nearly $100,000 in investable liquidity. Once you get to that point where you've got six figures in investable liquidity, years worth of expenses that are readily accessible, opportunities begin to multiply in front of you. There is no one right path from that point on. I mean, in Set for Life, I talk about a couple of themes like index fund investing. Because you're house hacking, you're naturally building a real estate portfolio. You can just continue moving on from house to house, which you know is kind of like training wheels for a real estate portfolio. That's what I'm doing. Actually, I invest in real estate, and I bought another quadplex back in mid-2017, and I'm going to buy another property here in 2018, just like one a year. And I throw the extra cash that I am generating and don't need for those down payments into index fund investing. So I'm doing both of those things. And then, of course, you have play money with which to try at small little assets. You know, you could spend, you know, a couple thousand dollars and a couple thousand hours writing a book, for example, if you wanted to create another asset. You could try up starting a podcast or a website or some sort of trial thing. And because you now have actual money and resources to throw at it without fear of totally losing your investment and having that be a significant detriment to your life, you could begin taking shots at various little opportunities one by one. And eventually, if you put the effort in and you are enthusiastic about them, you should get lucky with one or two of them, talk about luck again, and have something work out for you. And so I think there's no one right path once you get past that six figures of investable liquidity. It's just enjoy the good problem of having more opportunities than time.
Wow, that is a powerful cap. And what struck me as you were saying that is tying it back to, I think, episode 52, where we were talking with Todd Tresidder. You have a foot on all of these different asset classes. You have pursued the real estate asset class. You have pursued the paper assets or in passive index investing. And then on top of that, and actually this is kind of where I wanted to highlight as well, in some way you are in this entrepreneurial asset class as well, the business asset class. But what's so unique about what you've done, and I think for me it was a real eye-opening experience, was that instead of starting your own from scratch, you got involved in somebody else's and you helped them 10x their own project. And by realizing that for you, it was more valuable to have a commission-based income stream, which is based on performance, which is based on growing the business, as opposed to some flat rate, you're willing to take on a little bit more risk for yourself. But because you have the time and the passion and the energy, and because now your passions are so aligned with what you're actually doing, you have had tangible results within a very short period of time. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on someone, instead of getting involved and maybe starting their own business from scratch, actually finding a business that is in line with their vision and their passion and going all in on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before I talk specifically about that, you know, I want to mention this concept of risk and reward, right? When you are a full-time worker spending nearly all of your income, you know, more than 80% of your take-home pay, losing your job is a huge risk if you have no cash to fall back on and a high spending rate. Once you have a low spending rate and a lot of cash to fall back on, at least for me, it began to seem like more of a risk to stay at the company I worked at as opposed to have a chance to live up to my potential. And so that shift in perspective happens differently for everyone. Some people are able to do that and start a business by going to a VC firm and raising $100,000 and just burning through it and seeing if they can make money before they run out. And that is crazy to me, but that's perfectly acceptable for some people. Some people are willing to start a business at the point where I was with 25K and just see what happens. You know, I probably would be more of a comfortable starting a business or becoming an entrepreneur now with thousands of dollars in passive monthly income and hundreds of thousands of dollars in net worth and hundreds of thousands of dollars in liquidity. Where's that trade-off for you? Where's the point? You know, we hear about when do people leave FIRE? It's the same exact concept. It's, you know, some people need to get to that 4% rule. Some people need to get to 3%. Some people need to get much farther. It's wherever that comfort level is for you. And that's the power of having that strong savings rate. Now, that concept that I just explained to you is exactly why I joined Bigger Pockets as opposed to trying to become an entrepreneur myself. That was where I felt comfortable with that trade-off for risk and reward based on my personal financial position at the time, my career experience, and all the other factors that were going on in my life.
But Scott, you certainly had entrepreneurial upside at Bigger Pockets, and that is a cool step. I love how you have said time and time again about A, luck, and B, one quote you said before was increasing the odds of success. And it strikes me that you're constantly looking for that in your life. And it sounds like Bigger Pockets was the perfect opportunity for you.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that things that increased the odds of my success at Bigger Pockets were the fact that I was so passionate. I mean, the amount of times you would find me here, you know, not here, we're at a new office now, but at the office at 10 o'clock at night writing for the blog. Josh wouldn't let me write for the blog during my – he was like, I'm not paying you to write for the blog. I'm paying you to do these things for the business. I'm making Josh sound bad here. But, but like that wasn't my job. My job was not to write for the blog. And I was this stupid kid that didn't have any expertise there, and I wanted to write. And so – I wrote and I got crushed by the commenters, smart real estate investors that would pick apart my arguments and say, you have no idea what you're talking about. And I would just stay late trying to get better and better. I would use that as fuel, and that kind of passion and desire, learning from the users, wanting to become a real estate investor, wanting to build my portfolio. I think all those things absolutely really synergized with my work here at Bigger Pockets. So I think that finding something that you're interested in, enthusiastic in, and willing to throw yourself at will increase your odds of success for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You know, what strikes me is that you are willing to be wrong. Yeah, and you're willing to fess up to that, and then your ideas get better over time. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of what I brought to the table initially was enthusiasm. And because I'd heard all these other ideas, but I hadn't built a framework with them. And when I read your book, I see someone that has a framework for their life choices, especially when it comes to their financial choices. And it's really cool just to see how you've thrived in all of these different asset classes and how you're turning that around. And within a relatively short period of time, 3-4 years, you are becoming that mentor for tens of thousands of people that are following in your footsteps.
That's what's crazy is I think that what I'm doing is kind of normal and repeatable for most. I mean, maybe not the bigger pockets part of it, but the network that I've built, but the income and the financial things that I'm doing, I think are extremely repeatable for most people. And that's what's kind of crazy is I think that last year at this time, no one would really care about Scott Tretch, you know, but now that I have a book and have written about it, oh, hey, here's this guy. He's like, no, I'm a normal guy and I live a normal life. And I happen to have a book about finance because I think that it's a pretty common sense, practical way to just build your wealth. And that's very cool. But I don't want this to be like, oh, this is a really hard thing to reproduce, or you have to be really unusual or passionate. No, you have to want financial freedom and be willing to put a plan in place and be willing to accept many different perspectives along that way so that you can make the correct choices for yourself.
Scott, I'm struck by this. You latched onto this so early, right? It was just a couple of months out of college that you found Mr. Money Mustache, realized that your initial job, while sure making a great salary, this was not a long-term goal for you. We're constantly talking about second generation FIRE here, you know, and how do we get these people who are young, who haven't made quote unquote bad decisions about housing or cars or whatever it may be, how do we get them on board with FI when they don't even understand what a financial life is like or what the, I don't know, almost like horror show of having to work for 45 or 50 years at a job without ever taking more than a week of vacation at a time. That's kind of hard to explain to someone, but I'm curious if you've ever sat back and thought, how do I reach those people? What's the best message? Have you reflected on that? Have you tried different messaging? Like, is there anything that gets through better to 22, 23-year-old kids in your experience?
I've thought about this at great length, and I've annoyed, I don't know if I can say this, but I'm going to say it anyways. I've annoyed the hell out of everybody that I know at some point. Not everybody that I know, but friends, family, that kind of stuff. While I was getting on the journey to financial independence, while I was doing my first house hack, like, here's what I'm doing. It's great. You got to read this guy. You got to do this. You got to do it. You got to do it. And then what happened was it worked exactly the way I thought it would work. And then I now have a large amount of assets and passive income. And I can't go and be like, oh, yeah, it worked. You should have done what I did. That doesn't work anymore, right? So basically, what I'm trying to say is you're going to be annoying if you're going to people that don't want to hear about this message and trying to spread it. This is not something that they want to hear from you. And so what you have to do is you have to live your life and pursue financial freedom for yourself and live a good life and be a good example. And people will come to you over time. And those are the people that you can talk to about this, right? I'm not pressing my book on everybody I meet and trying to get my friends and family and all to read it. They know I have it because it's a accomplishment of mine, but it is not something that I'm now attempting to spread to anybody that doesn't want to hear it. People, I think, need to ask in order for you to inform them. You can share with what you're doing and why, but the moment you say you should be doing this, that's when people begin to shut down on it. I think that's the hard truth there.
Do you think that now that you're the Trenchinator in 2018 and people are stumbling onto your...
Is that my new name now?
Yeah, is this a thing?
It will be. It will be after this episode. Just let it simmer for a little bit. It's been in the interwebs for a while now. I'm going to make it a full-on thing. Power of Choose FI.
Actually, so we have a work Slack at Bigger Pockets, and Brandon made a Photoshop where he superimposed my head with sunglasses onto Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator.
I will find that.
I'll send it to you, and you can put it in the show notes. But I got that right there. And I think captioned the Trenchinator. So it's very weird.
Total coincidence. So now that we've been able to make that a reality, I guess going back to my original point was people told you it wouldn't work or that you were crazy or kind of just gave you that pat on the head, but did not in any way make you feel like you had that full support. It was kind of more of, oh, that's nice. He's trying something else. Do you feel that now that you've actually done this and you're talking about it on the Bigger Pockets platform, you had this book that's been published, that more people do find it, and because they found it on their own, now they come to you and ask you about it?
Yeah, I think that's spot on in the sense that, yes, more I'm surrounded now with more and more people that are interested in it. And the question I'm always asking myself is, has the movement, the financial independence movement, grown? Or am I just more in tune with it now? And I don't know how to separate myself from it very well. You know, I like to think that in 2013, nobody was doing this. But Mr. Money Mustache already had millions of viewers at that time. This is not new stuff that we're talking about here. People were doing it. People were biking to work. People were house hacking. I just didn't know them. And now I do. And so I feel like it seems like we have this big belief that, hey, our movement is growing. I think it is. And we want it to grow. We want more people to take control of their lives and become financially free as early as possible. But what will happen for sure is that you will at least begin to surround yourself with more people. I think it's hard to gauge whether or not the entire concept is spreading to more and more people as a percentage of the population.
Yeah, that's completely fair. And it is hard to know. It seems as if anecdotally that it's gaining steam. But to your point, we're also immersed in it. So it's hard to separate yourself out. But I know Jonathan and I get tons of messages from just regular people who were just introduced to it and said, hey, I love this message. I'm going to spread it to my friends and family. But yeah, you just don't know how far and how wide it is spreading. But it seems as if the message is getting through to people.
Yeah, and I think it takes probably 5-10 times for you to hear the message from different sources before maybe it clicks. I don't know exactly when it was, but I think it was probably during that financial independent radical personal finance podcast with Mr. Money Mustache back in 2013. That was when it clicked for me. But I had known about this stuff. I'd been reading it for a while, but that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm committed. I don't know when that is going to be for people, but it takes a certain number of these kinds of podcasts or blogs or books in order for it to really hit home.
Yeah. And Scott, how fascinating that your first guest on your Bigger Pockets Money podcast was also Mr. Money Mustache.
Oh, that was surreal. Yeah.
Now, for the people in our audience that aren't aware of the context for this, I know you just started a podcast, Bigger Pockets Money. And what's so exciting is that you partnered with Mindy, who many people in this community know as Mrs. 1500, to create that podcast. So I'd love for you to talk to our audience a little bit about what the idea behind that was and where you see it going.
Yeah. So Mindy and I are probably the two biggest personal finance nerds at Bigger Pockets. We both work here and we love it. Mindy, Mrs. 1500, is financially independent and she really enjoys spreading the message of personal finance and, you know, she loves talking about real estate and all that. So she's our community manager. And we thought that we would be a good team for a podcast about personal finance. One of the things that frustrates me a little bit about real estate is people that have no income, no assets, and have years of bad personal financial behavior think that they're ready to begin investing in real estate and that's their cure-all. But I believe that really it's the reverse. You have to get your financial house in order first and then invest from a position of financial strength in order to accelerate your position. I like it when real estate helps improve my financial position or accelerate my growth, but I'm not dependent on any of my real estate properties for my financial position, if that makes any sense. So that's the kind of the theory behind this. And then we want to spread good financial habits, spread the message of financial independence, and help people move to that point from which they can begin making serious, significant investments. And so yeah, we had, you know, the first step of that is going to be embrace frugality, begin saving, begin doing all the things you need to do to get your saving, you know, build wealth, investable capital, and that kind of stuff. And that's why Mr. Money Mustache was such a perfect and gracious first guest. And that day was just so surreal for me. I went up, I drove up instead of biked. He was far away. I met with him.
With that brand new Corolla.
It's now brand, you know, 4 or 5 years old. And we met and we hung around. We saw the place that he's working on. He's built a Mustachian headquarters, which is pretty fascinating. He got a great deal and has really turned the place around. It was, you know, in pretty bad shape when he got it. Yeah, it was just a kind of surreal day. We discussed a lot of things like self-driving cars and Bitcoin, all that stuff. A couple days after we met, he came out with an article, Why Bitcoin is Stupid, which I 100% agree with, by the way. And yeah, that kind of stuff. So that was a great day. But then the other episodes, we were talking about various different things. We're talking about grocery shopping. How do you bring your grocery bill down to below, you know, how do you do that as efficiently as you possibly can? For that, we have Erin Chase from $5 Meal Plan. And she gives a fantastic overview of how to how to really get dig in and eliminate one of these large expense areas. And that's great because that's a very actionable way to take that first step. You know, it takes time to change your housing situation or reduce your commute time. You're not going to be able to do that next week, but you can go out and begin making some strides and eating a little bit healthier and saving hundreds of dollars a month by planning out your grocery bills a little bit better. And then we're going to move on from topics like that. We talked to Tiffany Alice, and Tiffany runs a website that talks about how people can really go from bad financial positions with bad debt, that kind of stuff, back to a position from which they can begin creating wealth and accumulating assets and that kind of things. We talked to Sarah Wilson, the Go Budget Girl, and she was a fascinating story. She had $30,000 in debt and was earning a very low income, around $30,000. And she was able to pay that off in 2 or 3 years just through mad hustle, and is now on the journey to becoming financially free, back to zero now. And those are the kinds of stories that people need to hear, that you need to get through those issues before you can begin really aggressively pursuing financial freedom. So our goal is to make this accessible to everybody and get everybody to the starting line of financial freedom, and then go into, you know, we will also, I'm sure, cover more advanced investing topics and, you know, entrepreneurship, all that good stuff.
That's exciting, man. We'll definitely put a link to your show in the show notes for people that want to check it out. I love that you're bridging that gap, and I think it can only help as we continue to spread these ideas and bridge the gap between real estate investing and passive index investing. There, you know, these don't have to exist in a vacuum. These silos can be brought together, and they will have a synergistic results when you realize that you don't have to be all in on one hand.
Absolutely. I almost never meet a real estate investor or even just a wealthy individual in general that has all their money in stocks or all their money in real estate. Almost never. It's almost always people are like me, you have both. You invest in various different things and you build out a portfolio.
Awesome. We weren't able to go into real depth, so we're going to put a link for your book in the show notes for anybody that wants to check it out. But if they want to reach out to you, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Well, you can find me on Bigger Pockets. My Bigger Pockets email is scott@biggerpockets.com. And if you want to talk about something that's related to the book, you can email setforlife@biggerpockets.com. My book, if you're trying to save money, go to the library and request it. That's great. You can also buy the book on Amazon. You can buy it on Barnes & Noble, and you can buy it at biggerpockets.com/setforlife. That's SETFORLIFE, not the number.
Oh, you should grab it both ways.
Yeah, probably.
Missed opportunity. All right, Scott. Well, normally that would be the end of the episode, but on this show, we'd like to give you a chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Let's do it.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
All right, so my favorite blog that's not my own is Mr. Money Mustache. That's the one that changed my life. I'm sure that other people have heard that many times on this podcast. So I'll mention another one called Financial Samurai, which I enjoy as well. I think that Sam is a pretty smart guy.
Yeah, I think in the last couple of weeks, I've heard his name pop up several times. So, Brad, we really do need to reach out to him.
Yeah, that would be a very good future guest. So thanks for reminding us, Scott.
Awesome.
And Scott, your question number two, your favorite article of all time.
My favorite article I mentioned earlier on the show was How to Hack Your Housing and Get Paid to Live for Free by Brandon Turner.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think I can stress what an influence Brandon Turner and Josh Dorkin had on my life in terms of creating the podcast and the format that they created. There's a lot of overlap between the way that Bigger Pockets tackles a podcast and the way that Choose FI tackles a podcast. And it was that idea of creating a community and bringing on people that could add these different elements to a specific strategy that you wanted to implement. And I tell you what, after listening to them for 2 weeks straight, I wanted to go all in on a different way to tackle real estate every single day. I mean, it's almost overwhelming how much information they bring to the community.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I think that the theme is you're listening to smart people with contrasting opinions on various different things. And that is how you learn and be able to make good decisions. And that's what the Bigger Pockets podcast provides and helps out with.
All right, question number three, your favorite life hack.
So my favorite life hack is going to, I'm going to give you two. One is house hacking. I mean, I've described that many times. I also like to bike, which is a good hack for getting people started. I'm going to give you guys some credit because you guys changed. You know, I had a glaring weakness in my own personal financial position, which was the travel hacking thing. I'm 27, so I go to a lot of weddings. That's a big expense for me, as I get friends from around the country and I got to go to these things. And so I'm right now in the middle of pursuing my Southwest Companion Pass with the Southwest Premier Business Card. I think it is the one I started with. And I just finished my Chase Sapphire Preferred card. So thanks to you guys, I'm doing that now. And I've already been able to use some of the points from this program to save me hundreds of dollars. So that one was actually very eye-opening to me.
Nice. I'm actually working on my companion pass right now. By the time this episode airs, I will hopefully have it completely locked down. But it sounds like we're about in the right place. And certainly if you're listening to us in the beginning half of the year, that is the time to start working on the companion pass.
Yeah, I love that concept. That was huge.
Yeah, that's really cool, Scott. I'm glad to hear it. And yeah, for everybody out there, we're my wife and I are finally back under Chase 524. So we're able to open up cards. We just opened up the Sapphire Preferred each. So yeah, it sounds like all three of us are working on very similar approaches right now.
I think it's great. And by the way, I want to plug your show because I listen to your show and I think it's fantastic. And I have a number of episodes like that. I like Chad Carson's. I liked Fiery Millennial from Gwen, and I like Todd Tressiter. I thought you had a bunch of great guests on these episodes, and I've really learned a lot. So I think you guys are doing some great things here, and no surprise to me that you have one of the fastest growing podcasts and communities in the space here.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's really been a privilege to be a part of this community, and honestly, to go from listening to it on the sidelines and soaking this information up just like you were to just how can I get involved, right?
Absolutely.
All right, Scott, question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
So I'm going to give you two here as well. One is that new car I mentioned earlier and spoiled this question for you. And the second was failure to travel hack. I had just dismissed, I had known that travel hacking existed and that smart people were talking about it. I just failed to take action on it. And that's cost me probably several thousand dollars, maybe $5,000 or more over the last couple of years.
Wow. That is incredible. When you put it together, you know, when you stack several years of missed opportunity together, it really becomes apparent what sort of money you're talking about. And if you're a business owner, it's even more profound, especially with the amount of spending that can be put on a card and it's just evaporating into thin air. So yeah, I don't blame you for highlighting that. And I think that many people don't realize how many specific aspects of their life there are for room for optimization. I think the biggest thing between taking action and just kind of looking at it and thinking, what are those weirdos doing, is just maybe knowing one person that's a trustworthy, reliable person that's doing it. And for me, it was Brad. I had heard about it from like the points guys, and you know, travel rewards has been around in the space forever. But it wasn't until I heard Brad explaining it on the Mad Scientist podcast over a year and a half ago that it solidified for me. And the same as it did for you. And I said, wow, what a missed opportunity.
Yeah, if I could go back and rewrite Set for Life, I would say to eliminate your transportation expense, you do two things. You bike to work or walk to work, and you travel hack. And that actually is what will wipe out that entire 17% of the average American household spending, or the vast majority of it, is those two things combined.
That's so cool, Scott. And I love how open you are to changing your mind and getting new information, right? Like you said, you were kind of obstinate and kind of dismissed travel hacking. But the more you learned about it, the more you listened. Okay, hey, this sounds legitimate and I've heard it from legitimate sources. Let me try it. And now it's changed the entire way you think about traveling. So kudos to you. Don't beat yourself up about the lost opportunity. Just look at it as, hey, I'm moving forward in the right manner. And that's how I advise. Everyone can beat themselves up about things in the past. And we constantly tell our audience, the only thing you can do is make good decisions going forward. So yeah, that's more to the audience than to you specifically, because I know you're not really beating yourself up about it, but it's an important point nonetheless.
Well, I'm going to give the kudos to you because you're the one that got me doing this.
Well, thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. All right, Scott, question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
So I would encourage my younger self to start earlier, particularly in college, when there's a lot less risk, drink a little less, and try starting a few businesses or intern or join a startup in high school or college. Those are risk-free ways to try your hand at big opportunities that cost nothing. And, you know, that's the perfect time to do it if you're looking for these things. If you have that opportunity, try doing it earlier in life before you get going into that career, because, you know, it was a struggle to break free from that career for that first year where I had to really kind of cut back and sacrifice and spend much less, for example, than I have to now in order to live a happy lifestyle and achieve a high savings rate. And so you know, if you don't do those things, if you don't get started earlier in life, you're going to have to go through this period of sacrifice, or at least cutting back a little bit and making some big changes, disruptive lifestyle changes, in order to launch towards that that first savings level.
I would love to slow down and talk about that one actionable point you gave there. You said for that high schooler, try to get involved in a startup because there's no risk there. I mean, practically, what does it look like? How does that high schooler get involved with a startup? What direct actionable tips would you give to a high schooler that says, I want to pick a different path and I want to find a startup to go work for?
Well, you know, you see these stories of these guys that are doing this all the time. For example, one of the things that struck me was this kid named Jordan Cox, and he was the coupon kid out of the UK. He came with his mom. He was awesome. He had already been learning how to build a website, how to generate traffic, how to help people save money. I think he's changed. I think he's rebranded now as an adult from the coupon kid to, I think it was like 15 at the time. And now he's like 18, and he's rebranded. And he's a moneysavingexpert.com, which is out of the UK. And he just goes to places and tells people how to save money on household items and all these different places around the UK. Go to the shop and we have a good deal here. Here's how to do this kind of hack. That kind of thing, starting in high school, I mean, that kid has already got a thriving business, and he will never have to incur the expense of a college education unless he wants one. He will never have to enter into the corporate world. He has already got that foundation set, and he did it risk-free while still in school, while still, you know, before graduating the equivalent of the United States high school. Then you see stories about this every once in a while across the country. It doesn't seem like it's that hard to do. And even if you fail, at least you have that experience to fall back on and you can talk about it later.
I was thinking about that as well. It's that portfolio. If no one ever goes to your website, if no one ever looks at it, the skill set that you've built just by trying, and the fact that there's virtually no barrier to entry to start with this. You need a computer at home that you can work from. I've seen Brad's home computers, not very impressive. And he's built three businesses now online from his home. And so this is something where if you're willing to just stretch yourself and pursue something that is outside the norm, it goes back to those tips we talked about earlier. Just be willing to take action on something, immerse yourself in a community that's providing you good information. And over time, opportunities just open themselves up to you because you've positioned yourself to be ready when they land.
Yes, that's a whole theme of working towards financial independence in the first place. Yes, you'll have a happy life. Yes, you'll have control over your day. Yes, you'll have all these things. But really, not very few people achieve financial independence and then sit on their bum all day drinking margaritas by the beach and call that a happy life. Almost everybody that goes and has some sort of opportunity, financial or otherwise, where they can go and make a positive impact on the world. And by continually setting yourself up and doing it earlier and earlier in life, you increase your odds of recognizing and acting on those opportunities.
All right, Scott, so you're 27 years old and you have reached financial independence or financial freedom. Basically, your world has opened up to endless opportunities. At this point, it's just you picking what do you want to do. I'm curious, since you don't have essentially zero transportation cost and zero housing cost at this particular point in time, how much were your annual expenses last year?
They were about $30,000.
And it's amazing how far that goes when you're not paying to live somewhere.
Yeah, I think I live a very extravagant lifestyle on that $30,000. Now, I was living on less than that a few years ago. But like I said, I like my wings. I travel a little bit more. I go out to eat a little bit more. I'm not quite as good about making lunch every day and all that kind of stuff. There's some dates. I have a girlfriend now, so there's some of that stuff. That's the point of this, is because I have some passive income, even if I was earning a median income still, you know, $65,000 or so, I would still have a 50% savings rate, and that's expanding because of my passive income. So I think that's the magic of going through that first couple of years where you really struggle to accumulate that wealth and then invest it, is then you have that passive income and you reduce your expenses and you can buy back the things that make you happy. One point I want to make on this is Joel from FI180 had a great example of this. He was spending over $111,000 per year, and he showed a graph of his expenses and went down to like 80 the next – 2012 was 111. The next year, 2013, was 80. Then it went down to like 60. Then it went down to like 40, and then it went down to 25. And then it went back up to I think it was 30 or 35. And that was his happy level. And I think that was a concept that really stood out to me is, hey, a lot of people, when they start doing this, they go too far. And I think you should cut out all these things and see what living on the bare minimum is for a year or so. And then you put the things in place once your financial position is improving that make you happy and you stay at that level. And that's where I'm at now.
Wow. Talk about taking – I was basically setting you up so I could ask you a softball question about what you spent on Amazon, and you turned it into its own self-fulfilling content that I could talk about endlessly.
I can talk about this. I'm sorry. I ramble out of sometimes with these concepts. Go ahead with Amazon. Yeah.
All right. So on $30,000 a year, on a living expenses of $30,000, what is your favorite purchase from last year? And this can be on Amazon or somewhere else.
So I bought myself two things, one for fun, one for work. The work one I set up a home office, which has been huge because I'm sometimes a little obsessed with my work because I love working at BiggerPockets and I'll stay late. This gets me out of the office every day at 5. So I go home, enjoy myself, and sometimes I'll catch up or do like work on or write an article or something like that. So that was great. And then the second thing I did was I bought a Xbox because I've always liked video games. I gave myself the carrot on the stick a few years ago. Oh, I'm going to be able to reach 5 and then play video games for the rest of my life, and they're going to get exponentially better, and that's going to be what I'm going to do. And I ended up not really playing that much. So I bought an Xbox and I play a little bit of video games now. And that's fun for me.
That's awesome. And Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your time with us. This has been a total blast.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys. I've had a great time chatting about finance with you.
To our community, I hope you got value from this. I hope you realize that there are almost an infinite number of ways to tackle the game. I hope that when you're listening to Choose FI, you realize that we're not dogmatic on any particular lane, but we are dogmatic on the fact that you need to take action. Your path won't take care of itself. It's up to you to go get access to good information and then implement it into your life. And over time, just continually get better by 1% at a time in every single aspect of your life. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of this community. If you want to support us, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.